I just came back from 2 weeks in Tucson, Arizona, and Tucson was my hometown. It's where I grew up. I grew up in the home my parents built in the mountains west of Tucson, in the upper Sonoran Desert. And it was just one of the loveliest experiences I've had in quite a long time. A friend of ours who happened to be down, we're down there in part to celebrate my birthday. A friend of ours who was down there as well said that she hadn't seen me looking that happy and at ease for a very long time. So, and there was something about this place where I'd grown up, and I could see all four of the mountain ranges that formed the San Pedro Valley, and I just felt at home in a very fundamental way. And it was my intention tonight to actually talk about this notion of what does it mean to be at home? What does it mean to be in a place where you feel you belong? Is that tied only to place, or is it as much as anything else a state of mind? And how do we recognize and cultivate that sense of refuge, that sense of being at home in our own hearts? Well, that was my intention. While I was away, I was on a news fast. That's one of the reasons I was so happy. I wasn't reading any newspapers, and I wasn't listening to the radio. And I came home on the 15th of this month and didn't listen to the radio. And I was doing what I could to make, you know, my Sonoran Desert buzz last, you know. And then I got home and I did turn on the news. And I did take in fully what the trauma that I think the rest of the nation had begun to suffer as a result of what happened in the latest massacre du jour. And I realized that in terms of what's been going on in my own heart, that it was going to be much more useful if I were to speak of these things this evening in their relationship to the Dharma. And I also, just as I did a few weeks ago, we had a talk and we had some discussion on the practice of metta, you know, loving kindness, the cultivation of compassion and open-heartedness and joy and equanimity, and how necessary that is to do social action work. And so I find myself returning to that theme this evening. And like I did in that previous talk, I want to contextualize it a little bit by my own personal history with this issue as well. And as a Dharma practitioner and student, the way that I've come to make the decisions that I have with regard to what I want to do moving forward, which may or may not have anything at all to do with your own moral judgment. All I want to do is to share mine, because ultimately it's up to each of us to decide what our relationship is to these issues, how we most wisely feel it useful to bring the Dharma to bear, and how that informs our actions. So growing up in the desert, in the desert mountains, my father is a native of the desert mountains, and he came from a very poor family, and from the time he was a teenager, he was a subsistence hunter. He'd go out after school at the end of the day and shoot quail and doves and whatnot and bring them home for the family to eat, otherwise they wouldn't have any meat on the table. And so when I was about 12 or 14, he gave me his .22 that he had had when he was a kid and showed me how to use it. And I thought that was great, and I'd wander around the desert with my dog, and I would hunt rabbits, and the dog thought that was a wonderful idea, because as soon as I'd shoot a rabbit, you know, he'd run over and pick it up, and then he'd carry it in his mouth all the way back home again, a couple of miles, and I was very proud of myself as well, you know, my growing finesse at killing rabbits with a .22. Until the dog would get in, he'd lie down in the backyard with his rabbit, and he'd go to work on it, right, and he would rip it up and have, you know, eat the parts that he liked and whatnot. And then after a while, he got bored and got up and walked away. And there the rabbit stayed and was there through the night and was there the next day. And of course, by then the dog had no more interest in it at all. And so my dad said, well, time to clean up the yard. And so I got to experience, you know, the consequences of having done what I had done, killing the rabbit. It's about 14. I was out one evening at dusk in the Sonoran Desert. It's a really magic time. It's when the wildlife begin to come out and sunset is so soft and the sky is all pastel and color. And this gun, this rifle, the further away your target was, the more it lit up and to the right. So it was really tricky to hit anything at much of a distance. And so there was a cactus wren that came and landed on the top of a sorrel cactus. And it was at least 50 yards away. And so I figured what day, you know, I'd give it a try and let up and to the right what I thought was about right. Pull the trigger, and I hit it square on. And I saw these feathers flying in every direction. And there was a moment of real satisfaction, you know, of accomplishment, of achievement. And the next thing that I experienced was as if the bullet had gone right through my own heart. There was this really painful somehow or another, I connected to that act in a different way. And I realized the enormity of what I'd done. And took the rifle home and put it away. The only thing I ever used it for after that was to kill a rattlesnake on the front porch one time. But other than that, even having grown up in the Southwest and, you know, cowboy culture and all that, it just held no appeal for me. When I registered for the draft, it was as a non-combatant. I'd already realized by that time that killing anything was not something that I was ever planning to do again. And so I went into the service right out of high school and then into the Navy Hospital Corps, which is a non-combatant service. And I graduated from Hospital Corps School, and they gave me my ID card with the little red cross on it and the word medic printed on it. And so I really felt that I was doing right both by my country and by my own conscience in what I was doing. And so after a few months serving in San Diego, I got transferred to the United States Marine Corps 3rd Marine Division Ground Forces in Vietnam. Marines are actually, you don't like to admit it, they're actually part of the Navy, and they use all Navy doctors and corpsmen and dentists and chaplains and whatnot in the field. And when I was in Corps school, they told us all about the Geneva Convention and, you know, having, you know, Red Cross armbands on your arm and on the choppers that were carrying our wounded and our helmets and such, so we'd be promptly, so no one would shoot at us, right? And so, and then I got to Vietnam. And I realized that the other side hadn't read the Geneva Convention. And it was kind of like Marquis of Queensberry boxing rules anyway. They, you know, that's not how they were fighting the war. And so I quickly learned from the other corpsmen that going into the field, you had to do everything you possibly could to avoid looking different than anybody else. I also learned that this little 45 automatic sidearm that they gave us, you know, because that's the only arm you're supposed to have as a non-combatant, wasn't going to be much good in the jungle war. And so, since we couldn't get weaponry from the Marines because of the Geneva Convention, we went down into Da Nang and bought a M2 carbine on the black market with 230-round banana clips. And it was a very effective, lightweight rifle for taking into the field. The Geneva Convention was out the door, and I realized that under the circumstances, my only hope of survival was going to be to have some fairly effective weapon in my hands if I needed it. Happily, I never had to use that. The other thing that I discovered when I was in Vietnam was other ways that our side steered around the Geneva Convention as well. Because one of the rules they decided to make up about fighting gentlemanly wars in the future was that they would only use certain types of ammunition, which was a hardened piece of steel, because like in the Civil War, the weapon they were using was this longbore rifle that shot something called a mini ball, which is a big lump of lead, almost an inch in diameter. And whenever that would hit the human body anywhere, it could completely shatter any bones that it hits, with so many amputations. And so the idea was to try to have less lethal bullets somehow that would just go through the body, and that was it. No hollow point or soft ammo. So the Marine Corps was using a rifle called the M14 when I was there, which is pretty large bore and had a hard casing that, you know, a hard shell that would do what, you know, the NATO rules said. When I was there is when the Army had caused to be invented the M16 assault rifle. It's a very different kind of rifle from the M14. It's very small bore, it's not much bigger than the 22. It has an extremely high muzzle velocity. Also, per NATO rules, it has a hard-tipped bullet. What was different, however, about the M16 is that it was built for relatively close quarters combat. You know, so very high muzzle velocity, but the bullet slows up after a little while. More importantly, however, when a round from the M16 hits something, like another human being, for instance, what it does immediately on impact is it tumbles. Goes end over end, which means it has almost the same effect on a human body that the old mini ball did. Because the bullet tumbles, it smashes bone, it tears into flesh, it'll ricochet within the body. So it was a tremendously more lethal rifle than the one that the Marines have been using up until the case. It's probably about the deadliest combat rifle out there right now. You know, very carefully designed to really tear up a human body whenever someone's shot with it. And I learned that firsthand because about a fourth of the injuries and deaths that occur in war are what's called friendly fire. So I saw both Marines and Vietnamese who'd been shot with the M16, and so I was aware that this is a completely different category of weapon than anything I'd ever seen in the field before. Which is one of the reasons after I came home I got involved in doing anti-war work. So war is a really terrible idea and needed to come to an end. And set myself to that task and became pretty ardent in my views about the lack of wisdom in having armaments of any kind broadly available in American society, right up until my sister, who was about 11 years younger than me, she'd run off in her senior year in high school with this fellow. He was a welder who lived down in Louisiana, and so she moved down there with him, and he got her into, she's the first woman welder in Shreveport, Louisiana, so he got her into his union, and she learned this trade. He turned out, however, to be an extremely violent man with a very short temper, and who also smoked a lot of pot and drank. He was a stone alcoholic. And so he and my sister began to get into terrible fights. And so she left him, and he accosted her on a street corner in Shreveport one evening and beat her unconscious. And she filed a police report, got a restraining order, but she knew the kind of person this was. And so she also purchased a .32 caliber short barrel revolver and trained herself in how to use it and carried it on her person. And a few weeks later, after he had been doing some heavy drinking, smoking, he accosted her again. And he was again preparing to attack her. And she pulled her weapon. She was ready to kill him. And he understood that this was the case, so he backed off and went away, and he didn't bother her anymore. And so It's quite likely that, in fact, her having bought that pistol and trained herself how to use it, carried it with her, and pulled it, and was ready to use it, saved her life. And so that's, you know, in addition to my early hunting experience, and in addition to, you know, with this experience that happened with my sister, you know, I have some respect for some of the arguments that are, you know, attendant upon whether or not it's a good idea to have firearms around. But I've never made my peace with, you know, the return of military weaponry to the streets. It's always been something I thought was a tragic misconception. But I also felt a certain sense of, I don't know, despair. It's like, there's only so many things I can work on right now, right? So I give money to the, you know, the gun safety groups and whatnot, but that was about it. Right up until I started seeing those teenagers on television, you know, unlike any of the ones before, you know, like these events before, these were young people standing before cameras saying, "You were supposed to protect us. You were supposed to keep us safe. You were supposed to care for us, and you didn't. You failed us. You left us vulnerable." And I realized that that moment that these students, oh, a couple of things. One, that in some ways they were probably feeling much the same kind of vulnerability that I did when I was in Vietnam, you know, literally fearing for their lives. Realizing, you know, saying, this is supposed to be one of the safest communities in Florida. And there is, you know, the idea that no one is safe anywhere from attack by a weapon, the purpose of which is to gruesomely kill large numbers of people in a short period of time. There's something about their courage, you know, and then people saying, well, you know, maybe this time it'll be different. Okay, and it, you know, what struck me, you know, when I heard that is, it's only going to be different this time if we make it so. That's all. That's the only thing that's going to make a difference, is if we make a difference. And I realized at that point that, the other thing I realized at that point is that their lives are marked forever. For anyone who, for whatever reason, has experienced severe trauma, and for whom trauma is part of their lives, you know, as I do, that you carry that with you for the rest of your life. Your relationship to it may change over time, but it will never leave you. It will always be a part of who you are. And so I realized that for this last week or so, without even necessarily realizing it, I've been grieving fairly intensively. I've been grieving for the survivors and the families of those who lost children. I've also been grieving for the survivors, you know, because just like what happens to a round from an assault rifle, once it enters the body, so too is it with memories. You know, they will be with you for a long time, and it will take a long time to heal from those wounds. And personally, I realized at that point, I'm no longer going to be able to let those kids stand there alone. It's time for me to stand with them. And so, personally, I've come to the point where self-defense, hunting with, you know, anyone that needs a machine gun to bring down a deer probably doesn't need to be hunting in the first place. there are many other kinds of rifles that do a very good job at that. That at any rate, personally, I'm going to mobilize to associate myself with organizations that are focused on two things. One is studying gun violence as the public health crisis that it truly is. And the other is ridding our society of high capacity, rapid fire assault weapons, period. I'm also interested for those others who might be in the Sangha. I want to set up an affinity group in the Sangha, and I'm interested for others who might want to join in that endeavor in having it do three things. One is to do research on what the various groups are out there that are trying to work toward, making us a gun-safe society. What their different views are, what their language is in terms of, what languaging seems most in accord with, what the Buddha taught on these matters. And also interested in coming into alliance with other communities of faith around various activities that they may be involved in along these lines. And then the third is taking direct action, things like this march that's coming up next month, for instance. But staying at it, When I was doing, anti-war work and then peace work coming back from Vietnam, we kind of pled our case before the people who were in office, saying this is the bad thing, we shouldn't be doing it. And then for those political leaders who continued to vote to support the war, we began to work to vote them out of office. And I think, pretty much the same thing is going to have to happen now. The Buddha said, all beings tremble before violence. All beings fear death. See yourself and others. Whom then can you harm? Remember, it sounds a little bit like the Golden Rule, Jesus was saying, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. But putting that kind of dharmic spin on it, what he says is, see yourself and others. Which is to say, you are not different from that person who wants to live and who wants to be happy. And so, when I was watching these high school students on television, that's the phrase that came to mind. See yourself in others, It was my ability to, see myself in them. And imagine me speaking those words, days after the trauma that they had endured. And just as is the case with any other kind of social action, the thing that makes it different, that makes it possible to do so skillfully from the Buddha standpoint, is doing it from the perspective of the Brahmaviharas, of feeling compassion for yourself. I've been disinclined to acknowledge and to open to the degree of pain that I've been feeling over the course of the last week, for the surviving high school students and for the families of those who did not survive. It's, for me, every time I hear one of them speak, it's almost like when I shot that cactus for him. It's like, I feel touched, in a way that I have not allowed myself to feel touched when other mass shootings have occurred. They're so numbing and they're so kind of anonymous in a way, that I've just kind of wanted to turn away. I wanted to live in denial. Karuna, the Sanskrit and the Pali word for compassion, means quivering of the heart, right? It means being with the dukkha, the suffering that another is experiencing, not turning away from it, not numbing yourself to it. To be a bodhisattva is to endure pain. That, should have read the fine print before you took a Buddha term. To feel genuine compassion inevitably means feeling a certain amount of pain, of being with, of witnessing, of being in tune with, in sync with the suffering of another being. Doesn't mean blurring all boundaries. It doesn't mean getting so absorbed in the suffering of another that you debilitate yourself. Okay. it does mean not turning away. It means being there for, it means witnessing, it means being open to. And I think one of the reasons that this has been more difficult for me than any other of the massacres that we've endured over the years, the last couple of decades especially, has been for me not just thinking it would be a good idea, but to realize the absolute necessity of keeping the heart open to that kind of pain. Because being open to that kind of pain is what allows the compassion to flow forth, to allow it to flow forth first for myself. You know, I've been really just spend the last couple of days just really getting in touch with how much I've been hurting over what's been happening. But the reason I've been hurting so much is because at some level I decided to allow it to. And maybe it was the being away for a while or that kind of opening up that I felt. But for me right now, I'm feeling more personally shaken by these events because at some point I realized that I finally decided that I need to do that. I need to do that in order to do the work that at least for me lies ahead. And it means continuing to feel compassion for myself, making peace with myself, feeling compassion for those who were harmed and the harm that they're going to endure for years to come. Of trying to develop some kind of non-dual understanding of the views of those who feel it's really important to have all these weapons in American society. The common goal, I believe, is safety. Everyone wants to feel safe. And different of us have different ways of trying to achieve that goal. You know, personally for me, it's not having weapons of war on our streets. And so that's what I'm going to be working for. And that's pretty much where I'm with it right now. And the reason that I wanted to speak of these things tonight, that I wanted to speak in such a personal way, it's a little bit like coming out. It's like, okay, it's out there now. And so, not doing anything is, for me, no longer an option. It's just time. Something's changed. Something's turned around inside. Something is at work. Something's on fire in a way that wasn't before. So, you know, I promise never to use to try not to use the Dharma Seed as a soapbox, you know, to encourage a particular view on one thing or another. But I wanted to report as truthfully as I could, you know, where I find myself with these matters at the present time. And what I would like to do now is to just kind of open the floor. And so, for anybody who's been feeling some of the same kinds of feelings that I have, and I expect that there are quite a few of us who have over this last, you know, 10 days or 2 weeks. If you simply want to give voice to those feelings, and it doesn't, and we are one Sangha, and to me it does not matter a bit whether you find yourself coming to the same conclusions as to what action you may want to take forward as I do. This is a time for us to be together in safety and with open hearts to simply share. Yeah.
I was, it happened on the 14th Wednesday, which is Ash Wednesday. And I was on my way to Ash Wednesday Mass, and I was at Lincoln and 6th, and I looked up at the Channel 9 news thing, and there it was. I was just looking to see what time it was to see how late it was for Mass. And people brought it up at Mass, of course. And then I added a piece that, on the average, 80 people in this country die every single day from gun violence. And so I said, let's pray for the families and the people who died and the perpetrators of the other 65 who died. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I was thinking, right when I saw that, it like triggered something in me. Like, I feel like since the election, since this new administration, since all the terrible things that have been said, all the destructive things that are being done in our name, like the Environmental Protection Agency becoming the Environmental Destruction Agency, and I could go on, but I won't. When this happened, I thought, damn, I have PTSD. That's what it felt like. I'm suffering from PTSD. And this was the trigger that let me know I am. And I think much of the country was suffering from PTSD. And I really think that crossed over political lines. I think the governor of Florida was suffering from PTSD. Mm-hmm. And he's a very conservative man about which on social issues and politics, we agree about nothing. Mm-hmm. Nothing. When I get to this place, I'm going to do something. Well, I wrote 3 letters to the editor. The first one was not so, it was more tempered, and then the 2 others were less and less tempered. And then while I was doing that and doing a little research on the web, I discovered that Michael Moore had published a 28th Amendment to repeal the Second Amendment. And it was online from October of last year with the San Diego Free Press, and it is eloquent. It's not just the amendment. The amendment's only one paragraph. Then it goes into this explanatory thing. So I sent that to the New York Times and the Washington Post. It says, please, please reprint it.
Okay, thank you. Thanks, Jim. Please, anyone else who might wish to share? Please.
Hi. I'm visiting. And I'm from Washington, D.C., and I spend a lot of time around people who have the same political views and value system that I do. And I'm here in Colorado to visit a friend and some other friends, and also my partner's family is here. Mm-hmm. They're all members of the NRA. And one of the things that I've been struggling with is opening up dialogue on this particular issue with people who may not share a similar viewpoint.
Yes.
I've been thinking a lot about, or wishing a lot for, courage to do so, to find the words. And I think particularly struck a couple of days ago because my partner's nephew had a birthday and a photo came with him with a large toy rifle. It's his favorite birthday gift this year. And I couldn't say anything. I just couldn't say anything. And I think, you know, when I think a lot about Karuna, right?
Compassion.
So I'm a practicing social worker in D.C., and I have a lot of compassion for a lot of people, for victims of trauma, for perpetrators of trauma. Mm-hmm. And I am trying to find some shared something with my partner's family. It's just kind of loaded, you know, because I want to be liked.
Yes.
And yet I'm in a really important, I feel like I'm in an important space, you know, to open up a dialogue, and you know, so,
yes.
So I don't know why I'm sharing this, but I'm just struck that we're talking, that you've spoken about this, and I think the other thing I'll say, and why I mentioned the social work piece, is that I feel like I feel a lot of pain for a lot of people as part of my job, and mm-hmm. And I almost have to, I do have to go on news fast often.
Yes.
because I only have a certain capacity before I'm going to just collapse myself. Anyway, it's just been an honor to sit with you all, and it's something I needed, and thank you for this discussion.
I very much appreciate what you said, you know, because of the inevitable tendency to otherize and demonize those with whom you do not agree. I know people who belong to the NRA who do not agree with the leadership positions being taken by the organization. You know, so there is a diversity of views even there. And as you skillfully said, I think, how to speak of these things with wisdom and compassion, and especially to people that, you know, don't agree with where you're coming from, is Dharma practice. It's real Dharma practice, you know, to wish them well, to wish that they may not be afraid, because there's a lot of fear in there, you know. That we may not be afraid. Like I said, there can be powerful disinclinations to even speak of these things, you know, or to become public, to enter into dialogue with people that, you know, probably don't agree with you. That takes courage. You know, it takes the same kind of courage those high school students are showing. And it's a kind of courage that, for those of us who are up for it, that we need to be ready to exercise as well. It means dealing with our own fears. And that part of us, respecting that part of us that just doesn't want to do anything, that just wants to pull back and recoil and disengage, just so we don't have to deal with the power of our own feelings. And feeling that, you know, as we all know, probably from having done both things, to withdraw and to contract is to die a little. It's to be less alive, it's to be less fully here. It's to be not living our Dharma in a way that we otherwise can. Thank you. And Luke.
One thing that gives me hope is to see these young people speak out, which hasn't happened before, and saying, what are you going to do about it? You know,
yep.
Very different. That I notice is very different than the past. It is really inspiring to see young people do that.
And, you know, I think one of the things that gave them confidence is that these are issues they've been working on for months in their speech and debate teams. And so they were exceedingly well-informed. They knew what all the major points were because they'd had to argue both sides, you know, in debates. And so it's very familiar territory for them. And so I think that made it possible for them to speak with a certain authority that hasn't been seen before. Corey?
Yeah, I've just been thinking lately of, you know, what causes paradigm shifts. Mm-hmm. And I keep thinking there's something missing, although we're closer to it with the young people coming out. But what I keep coming back to is, I'm remembering a sort of turning point experience in my own life. Mm-hmm. This is about 35 years ago. I was going through a really hard time. And what allowed me to sort of break through, oddly enough, was at that time, I think in California, a man went into a McDonald's and killed 13 people. Mm-hmm. And I remember this person is someone I had very little in common with, different gender, different experience, mm-hmm. different age. But I had the honest empathy with this guy. I don't know if it's the right word, but I felt, I don't know, an understanding at his outrage. Mm-hmm. And I felt that toward the killer in Florida, too. Mm-hmm. You know, and wasn't hearing much about him, but he'd been abandoned, his parents died, he was just totally rejected. And there's that piece in the whole area of potential concern that seems to get lost. You know,
For a substantial number of the perpetrators of these massacres, they're horribly traumatized people themselves, you know, and that were not able to be helped in a way that might have, you know, gotten beyond what they did. But in as much as there are people out there, that there's something that seems important about denying them the means to care.
Sure, I guess, yeah. I'm wondering if there's any room in the Dharma for relating.
Say more what you mean about that.
Well, I mean, I think we've all felt that kind of, well, not we hadn't all, but occasionally people, you do come to a place in their life where they feel totally abandoned, and most of the time,
Yes.
People don't feel the need to, and of course, part of the problem is that he had the option of getting an AK, whatever.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, all the abandonment that came before he finally got to the point where he got the gun, you know, I mean, the culture doesn't support people who are lonely and abandoned.
Yes. First off, in terms of the Buddha's teachings, he was a practitioner of what's called ahimsa, and that's something that was already part of the teachings of Hinduism at the time. Ahimsa means non-harming. It means seeking out the welfare of all sentient beings, you know, seeking the welfare of all sentient beings. And so that is sort of core to the Buddha's teaching, and his teaching, you know, of the of wise and compassionate speech and action and way of life, you know, that lies at the very core of it. And the Bodhisattva vow is about the taking of compassionate action for the alleviation of the suffering of others. And that includes those who are victims of violence or survivors of violence, those who perpetrate it. And I think your point is very well taken about we find ourselves on the back end trying to care for ourselves and caring for survivors. And one of the things that seems really important to do, like you point out, is figuring out better ways to take care of people who are harmed and damaged and suffering on the front end, who might then be inclined to do something as horrific as what we're seeing happen in American society now. Thank you. Yes, please.
I remember in the context of the Columbine shooting that there were 13 students and teachers who were killed, and then the two shooters died. Somebody put up 15 crosses on a hillside near Columbine, and there was community outrage that there should be the two crosses for the shooters as well as the 13 who died. And I thought that the parents of those two boys lost their sons too, amidst all of the self-doubt about what could I have done differently, what should I have done differently that might have changed this, so that we forget about the people who are close to the perpetrators,
mm-hmm.
and the compassion that they need as well.
Of course. Those crosses were made by a devout Christian in another state, and he made them and he brought them over here and he planted them, and they caused the uproar that they did. Several churches in that immediate community lost their pastors within a couple of years of that event, because the congregations became very split on that same question. You know, what do the teachings of Jesus really have to say about all who suffer, you know, and all who sin, right? But for some, who, from the depth of their pain and their trauma, were not willing to see things that way. Yeah, but you know, it's like Sharon Salzberg says in the practice of Karuna, you know, leave no one out of your heart. The extent possible, right? Yes?
I'm gonna let you have your hand up first.
Okay, Claire, and then Leanne, yeah.
I
don't,
what's your name?
Kim, I'm Claire. Thanks for sharing. It's challenging for me, because I've been a mental health therapist for 20 years, mostly with kids and school counselor. It's challenging for me to speak about it because I was really, on one hand, angry that clinicians that work with kids have been putting their finger in the dike or the wall for at least since Columbine, and we do it for society and kids. It's a lot to hold. I was angry when the mental health, you know, pass the buck, it's mental health, because I worked in a college locally almost 10 years ago where I was for the first time doing threat assessments, and I had of adults that were felons on a college campus, which I'd never been trained, who phoned in threats to the campus. And I remember feeling so relieved because a psychiatrist that worked at another college, I ran this case by him, and he said, Claire, they don't want to admit it, but psychology was never developed to predict group violence. We just can't do it. And then the movie theater guy happened. And so I was angry. I feel that clinicians, mental health people have been holding this for society that does not want to reflect. My heart breaks because I've seen finally a huge increase in panic attacks in kids. They are. I was hired last year to do temporarily prevention work. So I think I was focused. I didn't do my mindfulness groups, and I did. But the counselors in this suburban middle school, they're doing child protection all day long. They're doing threat assessments and suicide assessments, and so I ended up, you know, backing them. And so I also worked down the street from Columbine for 3 years on a mental health agency, and this is the thing that I was partially angry but partially relieved that it's coming to the surface of what's been happening for years for these kids. Is my clients were high school students, and they're like, it never stops.
Right.
Where we don't make the news anymore.
Right.
Where they have bomb threats, active shooter drills. These are schools' reality, and so anger, but also relief, and then feeling guilty that I was relieved, that it's like poison coming to the surface for society, because I don't know if any of this resonates with you, because this is not new. So it's been very difficult. I worry about those kids and their trauma. I know it's empowering to get up there, but they're being threatened by the NRA and white supremacists online. But so it was complicated for me.
Right. Yeah.
But I feel like it needs to come to the surface. And then I feel bad because I don't mean that I condone any of it. I don't really.
Right.
But this is something that did not happen overnight, and I think for change to happen, it can't be behind closed doors of social workers and therapists and school counselors and all of that. And that's where it's been for a long time. So thank you.
Yeah.
I have a lot of thoughts.
Could you speak up a little bit?
Yeah.
I don't know if I can make sense of what all is going through my mind right now, but as a survivor of violence and as someone who works every day with other victims of violence, I want the violence to stop. I can't say that what happened in Parkland feels any different to me than any of the things that have gone before, but it's absolutely another opportunity to do something different, and it will only be different if we actually make it different. There is a group of kids there that are so eloquently saying what they need and what they're seeing and what needs to happen, and supporting them seems like a very good thing to do. The other thing, one of the things maybe, I come here, I leave the Dharma because I don't want to shut down, because I don't want to go through my life being contracted and dead to what's going on around me. And that's really, really hard to do. Trying to show up with an open heart is not easy. And the Dharma for me has to be something that I can act on, that I can actually use out in the world and not just be something I do on Sunday evening. The other thing that I wanted to point out is that this, as a Sangha,
this is where we have our support. This is where we have this whole group of people that mm-hmm. can support each other in whatever is up for people, whatever things are calling them to act or whatever they're going through. We have this really precious group of people who we get to meet here and see each other and support and encourage each other in whatever degree. But this is so important, and I think that's all I had to say for tonight.
Well, thank you for sharing it.
When I've been looking, I think of the story that you told Christopher Lloyd about, and I'm blanking out on it because it's new to me. It's about skillfulness, and someone was talking to the Brahmin, and the Brahmin asked a question to the Buddha, how did you do this? Like, you basically, you took my game. Like, how'd you do it? And the way that the Buddha answered was in using skillfulness, I think, using his language, the Brahmin's language, and I'm probably just not getting it right, but he was able to not reveal that the Brahmin was wrong, so to speak, but to speak to him and to sort of scoot him in the right direction, honoring his own traditions.
Exactly.
And when I think of this and other places that are really hard, it feels like that because I can look at myself, and that's where I have to start and say, where is it that I'm violent? Where does it start? Like, what are the tiniest places? And how do I learn about violence in myself? Because how it is in me is how it is. But then in this, it feels like there's another piece, which is intentions. And my intentions as a nonviolent person are probably different than someone who, it seems, is interested in making money using guns. So the skillfulness for me as I start looking is about how can I make a phone call to my financial organization and say, I'm writing a letter and say, I'm aware of your connection and I'm going to take my business elsewhere if you don't. Or looking at my investments and saying, where am I connected that I didn't even know? And really trying to be really skillful in the way that I approach it and not assuming that everyone's like me.
Exactly. Right. Thank you. Beautiful. You were talking about the Subha Sutta, the discussion with the young fellow where the Buddha is, like you said, able to use his language, his idiom, his insight into what was the question behind the question. You know, when he, how did you come to this place of realization? And was able to use his own language to help him get there. If we stay in touch with our own pain and the compassion that emanates from it, that becomes something that's possible to share with others. So you don't have to be condemnatory at the same time that you're truthfully witnessing the truth of your existence, you know, of where you're coming from. You know, saying in terms of my karmic connections, you know, I can't allow my wealth to be used in ways that I think is perpetrating this kind of violence. And it's not condemning the other, it's stating your own dharma, you know, stating your own truth. And that takes courage as well, but it can be done with kindness, as you said. It can be done in a way that can be heard. And it's how things change. You know, there is going to be this inevitable tendency to roll out the old rhetoric and, you know, the just kind of like pushing, you know, the replay button on an old tape and having the same phrases come forth on both sides of the argument. I think that what's very possibly going to make the difference this time, you know, there's a qualitatively different kind of discourse coming from the students because they're so well educated. and they combine that knowledge with the way they've been personally touched, you know. I think it, going forward in terms of trying to help bring about a more peaceful society, and one where we're not susceptible to that kind of mass violence, is probably going to require a qualitatively different kind of discourse. You know, I think that in some ways, whatever our particular views on issue might be, I do think that there's something that we have the capacity or the potential to bring to the process that is not otherwise always that much in evidence out there. You know, being able to be sufficiently in touch with your own values, your own, you know, sense of compassion for self and others, the Buddhist teachings on nonviolence, on ahimsa, but being able to live your dharma, to be your dharma in a way that does not have to diminish the other. You know, it's a true art form. And I certainly am a little more on it than others at other times, right? As I imagine the case is with us all, you know. For me, it's self-forgiveness, understanding the despair when it arises. I think what we have in common to some extent with those whose views may differ radically is fear. You know, I think it requires being and holding our own fears in a tender way, in a way that acknowledges them but does not allow them to cause us to contract and withdraw, but to move forward. In other words, you know, there's, from time to time you'll hear me talking about the devas, which are beneficially inclined or beneficially indented non-corporeal beings. And in sort of Buddhist folklore, you know, they're actually seen as these non-corporeal beings, you know, they're kind of out there kind of like angels, you know. And all I ask is that people keep an open mind about these things. But another way of understanding the devas is that basically what's going on, and they talk about the consciousness being in the deva realms, you know, when the Buddha talks about knows the exalted mind or the expanded mind to be the exalted mind, that in that way of understanding what's happening when the mind is imbued with these, fully imbued with these qualities of the Brahmaviharas, it's that the mind enters into the deva realms. And that when collectively we find ourselves, you know, like around the globe at any given point in time or whatever, when a certain number of people have entered into that realm, it kind of energizes it and it makes it available to others who need it. So that, for me, that's one way of understanding, you know. It's like we're called upon to be bodhisattvas. We're called upon to try to do this work from the deva realm, you know, from a place of beneficial intention. So that when we beseech their protection, it's there for us as well. So let's please take our sitting posture one more time. Allow the eyes to gently close and the attention to come to rest on the breathing. May we walk in safety, safe from all inner and outer harms. May we live with ease. May we all be happy and peaceful and free. Bhavatu sava mangalam, rakantu sava devatam. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Safe journey home.